his eyes flashing with a fanatical sheen. It was not holy! It was a den of stinking evil! My sires built this keep to keep them from it. It was thought that a strong military presence here would deter any future incursions into the duchy and keep the goblins in the mountains where they belong. They must not regain it, not while a single man in this vale draws breath. So, how is that working out? It succeeded brilliantly, didn't it? I said. To say my words were dripping with sarcasm would be dramatically understating the truth. For 150 years it did, he insisted, and it will work yet. We were not ready for this, not yet, that is true. The castle was finished, and I was beginning to school my people into becoming warriors as my sires instructed. But the goblins struck too soon, and in too great a force. How did we know that they had these witch stones, or so many numbers? We should have had another 20 years before they could have rebuilt their armies after the last war, and they should have forgotten about that pit by now. Your ancestors didn't think that they would still be pissed off after you killed their young and stole their gold and defiled their shrine. They could be controlled, it was thought. His manner changed from angry to apologetic, but for the entirely wrong reasons. Minilan, I didn't create this situation. I was born into it. But in reflection, I agree with the policies of my fathers. The goblins had no need for this valley. They do not farm or ranch. They are happier in the mountains. We have only taken what they could not properly use. It was their sacred valley, which housed a sacred shrine. That's what they used it for. How would you feel if one of them took a shit in one of Inneri's sacred wells, spilled spirits in Pyre's Ifnir's counting house, or turned a temple of Trig into a brothel? This vale was hallowed. Even the tree folk know this, and respected and honored it. To pillage a hallowed space, even of a god of goblins, is forbidden by the gods. There were worried glances around the room from the rest of the Wilderlords. No soldier, and particularly not knights, want to be on the wrong side of the gods. Desecration such as Brandmount had visited on the Gavanni was strictly forbidden under the codes of war. It was a military decision! Not a religious one, the Wilderlord insisted. The Duke did not approve at first, but the Baron didn't want a ready-made staging area for invasion left on his borders. Not one the Scrags would defend so potently. He bid my house to take the valley, despoil the cavern, and slay its defenders. He pledged the Vale to us as an independent domain in return. The duchy and his barony suffered greatly in that war, and leaving an intact foe in a protected area was not the way to avoid a second one. So it was a military decision, he rationalized. From the faces of his knights, they looked unconvinced. It was a poor military decision, as it turns out, I observed. That cave is evil, I tell you. We must keep them from regaining it at all costs, he insisted. It was where the horrors of the last war issued from. Undead? Terrors of the night? Even dragons, it is said. Left alone, in time they would have grown yet stronger, and unleashed them on us again. Building this castle was the only way to deny it from them. They must not be allowed to return to that vile place. He paused dramatically, and looked around the room for support. To be honest, his men were too confused and preoccupied to raise much of a cheer. Mine were like statues. During our heated debate, not one had moved their position an inch. I don't think you have much of a choice, I said sadly. There are 100,000 Gavanni outside your castle now. But do you know what is out there? Do you know what's coming this way? The old god of the Gavanni is even now headed through the mountains. I don't know what kind of super shaman he is, or even if he isn't the real divine thing. But when he gets here, that massive army out there will be redundant. If the old god, the great ghost, shows the same magnitude of power as his priests, then one old man in one little castle won't stop him from taking whatever he desires. But we are more, now, than one old man, Kusi insisted. Can't you see that? With the power of the witch stones and the additional troops, you and your comrades can rout this creature, whatever it is, and send these dogs back to their caves. Why can't you see that? Because I know what I'm talking about, and you don't. Sure, we have Aryanite, and now we have trained war magi who know how to use it. We might even stand a chance against that army out there, although I hope I never find out. But that thing, who desires back the caverns of Karomala, who covets revenge on House Brandmount and all of humanity, that is headed this way, is like a thunderstorm, Kusi. It's a big, fat, powerful, magical force of nature, and even with a bucket full of witch stones, I'd have as little chance against it as you would fighting a thunderstorm without getting wet. But we must, he pleaded. All of our hard work depends upon it. Can't you see that? We must defeat this goblin god, or all is lost. His mad insistence finally had worked me to the breaking point. Whose hard work? Yours? Your house's? The duchy's? What about my hard work? I came here at your bequest because you needed a spellmonger, and that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to cure warts, and sell love potions, and maybe meet some nice miller's daughter and raise a family. That was the hard work I wanted. But I remember how eager you were to have me after our service in Faerys. You set me up to get caught in an invasion and fight for my life. There are horrors in that cave? Well, perhaps we deserve a few, for letting ourselves be ruled by the scheming of petty wilderlords who would lead us into death and ruin for the price of their broken honor. The truth is, I don't give a damn about your ancestors, your honor, this castle, or that cave. I'm fighting for my life and the lives of those other peasants you suckered into your bullshit cause. I sighed, tired of the posturing and the threats. The truth of the matter, Kusi, is that I insist that you release the Lady Pentandra from her cell, and I recommend, in the strongest possible terms, that you order preparations be made to evacuate the castle. Need I remind you that I still rule here? That has not changed. That is the truth of the matter, spellmonger. My heritage aside, my worthiness aside, I am still lord here. I laughed in his face. And do you think that really means something anymore? Who will do your bidding, O righteous lord? Your lackeys here? I said, all pretense of civility gone. The mercenaries in the inner bailey who took coin from my hand? The Crinrock, who have sworn an oath to their own gods to obey me? The peasants who already look up to me? The war magi? My comrades? I had briefly met with representatives of all four groups before I entered his chamber, to let them know that there might be some political fireworks, while at the same time feeling them out on the matter. Well, no one wanted trouble, except maybe for the war magi, who were pretty pissed that this hayseed lordling had imprisoned a popular fellow mage on such a pretext. But all four groups had given me unofficial pledges of support. They were all concerned about Kusi's inability to grasp the strategic situation adequately. Kusi could count perhaps on his piecemeal mercenary outfits, his fellow nobles, and a few score of his regular household armsmen if it came to a fight inside the castle. I reminded him of the possibility of an uprising, every noble's worst nightmare, in a last-ditch attempt to release Penny. You may be lord in name, Sire Kusi, but a lord who ceases to act as one deserves not the title. History is replete with such fools. Forget that at your peril. I felt hot. The air around me crackled and danced as stray bits of magic leaked from my sphere, through the primal part of my mind that gave it thoughtless form. It was becoming increasingly difficult to not exercise that dark part of my mind. With a single thought, I could have erased this man from existence. It was tempting. So it comes to this, Sire Kusi said through gritted teeth as he lowered his sword, but did not sheathe it. I let him talk. I was silently arranging some last-minute spells while he spoke. Base rebellion. I had thought that you were a loyal and worthy ally, Minolin. It was whispered by some that I placed too much trust in you, that you had designs of your own on my lands, that you used your vaunted imperial training to becharm my people and turn their hearts away from me. I didn't want to believe it, but it is true. You lust not only for the loins of peasant sluts, but for my very seat of power, my lands and my sword. You will not be content with plying your trade honestly, serving a just lord. You will not rest until you are called lord in my place, they said. It has been suggested that the influence of the stones have made you mad, like poor Uruk, and that you were using them to influence my people and turn them against me. I have heard the stories, the true story, not the tales you have spread. And what would that be? I asked, amused. Well, perhaps not that amused. My pride does not rest on the foundation of my reputation. How your disgusting lusts drove you to work a charm on poor Uruk, and how, under your influence, he turned against his own master and brother apprentices. How he paid for it with his life when you feared the truth getting out. Really? I asked, my eyes narrowing. I barely spoke to the lad before that night. I know that you keep an agent of the enemy here to spy upon us. That, at least, will be taken care of. That stinking goblin dies within the hour. I have heard of the perversities in which you indulge in your tower, the sordid play you indulge in with your apprentice and your peasant whore. You speak of betrayal, but who betrays us now? Who betrays the laws of gods and men? With your vile perversions, you might as well go throw open the gates and invite the old god in yourself. And just who whispers such jagged lies into your ears? I hissed. Who regrets my presence here so much, and feels so ungrateful for the life I've given him by my actions, that he wishes to see us all to ruin before his own reputation is damaged? My eyes caught the movement of someone trying very hard to stay hidden in the far recesses of the great hall. But you can't easily hide from a mage with a witchstone, even if you have one yourself. Master Garkesko, I called, come out and face me. I kept my voice even. At first he hesitated, and I could see the debate whether to run or fight play out across his features. Then he came to some resolution, straightened himself and swaggered over. You rebellious upstart, he spat at me. He wore his Irionite shard in a silken pouch around his neck, and a dagger at his belt, but made no move toward either one. This is the loyal man who spoke to me of your true inclinations, declared Sire Kusi. A man with no incentive to lie. He has every incentive, I said, my voice filled with contempt. If he blamed Uruk's accusations on my bewitchment, then he could escape blame for the disorder in his own house, and tarnish my reputation at the same time. As I warned you before, he is a rebel, my lord, he said to Sire Kusi out of the side of his mouth, and he is dangerously willful. You were quite right to imprison his foreign bitch in your dungeon. Perhaps the threat of losing her will keep him in line. Together they would have wrought even more mischief, even ruin, if I am any judge. Garki, you're mad, I sighed. He speaks of madness. Such temerity. I once hoped the boy would look to me for guidance, become a protégé, if you will. He has some goodly store of talent, after all. But I can see now that he is unpardonably corrupted. His morals and behavior is repugnant. He strutted between the knight and I, secure in the protection of the lord, and I prepared for an attack spell. It didn't come. Garkescu wasn't a war mage after all. He was a third-rate village spellmonger with delusions of grandeur. He was depending, I realized, on my willingness to participate in the politics of the situation. Despite his occasionally skillful use of the art, magic wasn't something he relied on in a conflict. He was a small-time shopkeeper, using intimidation and verbal bullying to maintain his position in society, relying on magic for his status. But he angered me, worse even than Kusi. I had put in Garkescu's hand enough power to rival the greatest magi in the duchy, and he was resentful, not grateful. I raised my finger, and blue lightning crackled along its length. You lying, chicken-fornicating old— See the disrespect, my lord! From the first day he arrived in this vale, he has treated me commonly, even basely. He was jealous of me and covets my power, so jealous that he was loath to part with the stones for fear my greater experience with the art would upstage him. Garkescu's eyes lit up, just mentioning Irionite. The power had a potent hold over the little man, I could see. When at last he relented, he still refused to fully instruct me in their use, weakening our defense. So jealous is he. I did not want to level blame at such a time as we find ourselves in, but it is obvious that his misuse of his power has put us all in jeopardy, especially my poor young apprentices, he added sorrowfully. I suspect he used the youngest one damnably until the poor lad broke under the dishonor and slew the eldest. I kept my peace and let him talk. Every moment that Garki spoke, he was giving me more rope to hang him with. Uruk certainly showed no signs of disobedience, much less rebellion, until he was under Minolan's influence, he recounted. Indeed, Uruk was always a friendly and obedient apprentice. If his other habits are any measure, then I have no doubt that he attempted to seduce the boy, succeeded, and convinced the lad to strike out against me. He certainly makes enough noise with that slut. My chambers are directly below his, and the noise is interminable. Are you even certain you know what you're hearing? I taunted the old lecher. He ignored me. Minolan also failed to detect the breach in our walls. Or did he? He brought a prisoner into our keep, and has him treated like an honored guest. And then he has a troop of mercenary magi show up, seemingly in the nick of time, gives these war magi what should belong to the domain, while he riles the peasantry to the point of rebellion over trifles. That he has, sire, Sir Kay agreed, his eyes narrowing. I feel compelled to explain that last charge. A few days before this meeting, I had been returning to the castle from one of our terror raids, only to be met by a delegation from the Outer Bailey. It seems that Sir Kay, the castellan, had ordered a supply of bacon, originally intended for the rations of the common folk, to be diverted to the castle garrison in the Inner Bailey. The bacon in question, a few hundred pounds, had originally been brought from one of the prosperous nearby farmholds, not purchased by the castellan. The farmer in question had objected strenuously. Either the bacon was for the people, or it was available for purchase by the castle garrison. Sir Kay balked at either option, and turned the man away. The farmer had taken his problem to the quartermaster, Sir Olver, and when the old knight proved unwilling to listen to his case, he brought the matter to the attention of the informal council that governed the Outer Bailey. Before going directly to Kusi about it, they wanted my advice. I considered the matter, then pointed out that the garrison stored a few supplies in a shed next to the stables, and that I knew for a fact that two barrels of beer were stashed there for the refreshment of returning cavalry. I then mentioned that those two barrels of beer were probably worth about as much as 100 weight of bacon. As Sir Kay had been getting stricter with dispensing beer as supplies slowly dried up, they took this news gleefully and, I realized, saw it as a suggestion that I condoned, which, in retrospect, I did. As I went by to check on Traveller that day, I watched them attack the shed and liberate the beer barrels over the objections of a young guard, a militia soldier of 16 years, who was not about to draw his blade on such respected members of his community. The small mob took the two barrels, and only the two barrels, over to their encampment, and began to have a party. News spread quickly of the deed, and before long there was a crowd of very happy and defiant peasants gathered. Sir Kay came himself with 4 guards to fetch the beer back and punish the wrongdoers. An argument ensued. Sir Kay threatened to have them all imprisoned, whereupon 20 volunteers offered to stuff the 4 small cells under the castle, certainly the safest place to be in a siege. Sir Kay changed his mind, and threatened work details for all of them, and they just laughed. All of them had worked harder on repairing the breach than anything in their lives, and the thought of even cleaning latrines seemed like easy work in comparison. Finally, Sir Kay made noises about having the perpetrators thrashed. That got everyone's attention. But the menacing mass of common folk intimidated the guards into inaction, and in the end, Sir Kay himself had to retreat, with whatever shreds of dignity were still intact, while the farmers sang a rather rough little country drinking song about the stupidity of the nobility. As the castellan left, red-faced, he looked to me for support. I just shrugged and went back to my quarters, eager for a status report and a nap. Hell, I had more important things to think about than bacon and beer. It was a minor squabble, the sort of thing to expect from a group of regular people under enormous stress and the threat of dire peril. Castle life fluctuated back and forth from mind-numbing fear to absolute boredom, and little episodes like that relieved stress. But Sir Kay had obviously taken it wrong, reported to Sire Cusi, and when the Wilderlord heard about my little role in the incident, he had Sir Kay chew me out about it. I ignored him. Kay is a perfect castellan, keeping everything running as efficiently as possible under duress. But that also means that he's a complete asshole most of the time. In any case, Garkescu had apparently jumped on that as a sign of my rebellious nature, and got a complete agreement from Sir Kay. Garkescu is an asshole too. I let him continue. I wanted to hear every vitriolic word.
I wonder just where his loyalties truly lie, my lord. As do you. By his own admission, he merely wishes to preserve his own neck. He has no interest in you or your interests, my lord, except his envy of your position. I expect that when the time was right, he would do anything in his power to usurp your seat. Anything from a complex spell to a dagger in the back. He is dangerous, he hissed. And letting him at large to continue to make trouble is an unwise course of action. I suggest, my lord, that you strip him of his witchstone and have him confined.
You just try it, I sneered. Come and try to take it.
That's what the Lady Pentendra said as well, noted Sir Kay darkly.
And did she give it up? I asked, curious.
Well, no, he admitted, but she pledged not to use it to escape. She gave her word as a noblewoman. I could see that Penny and I would have to have a talk.
You are indeed rebellious, Minilan, and I cannot tolerate it,
Cusi pronounced, a mocking tone of false sadness in his voice.
If you beg my pardon now, and surrender your witchstone to Master Garkescu, then I will only sentence you to exile outside of the walls. You may take your sword and your horse, but nothing else.
Which brings us back to the matter of enforcement, I replied.
Are you going to try to take my stone from me? With my mates at my back, similarly armed. On the off chance that you survive such an encounter, are you going to be the one to explain to the War Magi, and the Crinrock, and the others, how you slew their captain? Or the peasant militia, who has come to see me as a leader? Those troops are not loyal to you. Try to enforce your gracious sentence, and it will be your own head that adorns a spike above the gate. Next to Garkescu's, of course.
You dare! Threaten me in my own chamber?
Cusi asked, aghast.
I do,
I said coolly. I gave you full opportunity to release Lady Pentendra without losing face. I asked you, and when you said no, I insisted. This is your last chance, old man. Release her, or I will tear this castle down stone by stone, and damn you and your cursed cave with every breath. Cusi's face twisted in anger, his eyes wide with rage at my threat.
I've had quite enough of this, you promiscuous peasant bastard. You can join your slut in the darkness until I decide to take your head. Seize him!
He ordered. Two or three men-at-arms started to do so, as did Cusi's brother, when the first of my spells went off. A long tendril of magical energy reached out and grabbed Cusi and lifted him about a foot off of the floor. His feverish brother suddenly found his sword too hot to hold, and the few others who had bravely and stupidly tried to execute his order were on the ground and writhing in pain. They were not being injured in any way. They just hurt. One of Wenek's favorite spells. I could almost hear him grinning behind me.
If anyone else wants to try to seize me, they are welcome to try.
No takers? Just as well. I've wasted enough valuable time with this foolishness. Let's take a walk, you and I, sire. My men will stay here with yours to keep them company and avoid any unpleasantness. Talaman had drawn his mage blade, which glowed brightly, while Wenek merely thumped his thick-set war wand into his palm over and over again. They were sufficiently intimidating that I wasn't worried about them getting rushed by the knights and men-at-arms, even if I'd just essentially declared a rebellion. While Cusi hung struggling in the air, his sword dropped on the floor, forgotten. I walked straight up to Garkescu and looked him in the eye. I have special plans for you, Master Garkescu, I said, softly, to his fear-stricken eyes. I reached out and plucked the pouch from around his neck. You are stripped of my gift. You are unworthy of it. By all rights, I could put a blade in your belly for the insult you have given me, and no one would object, nor would you be missed. You are a disgrace to the profession. Not only could you not keep order in your own house, which cost you the lives of two apprentices, but you are dabbling in the dark magic of politics. You know as well as I that the bans prohibit this. As a chartered mage of the realm, in the absence of a royal censor, I have the right to burn out your brain, keeping you from ever casting a spell again. Or I could kill you in a duel for the insult you have given me. But I won't do either. Instead, you may go for the rest of your life, remembering the power that you lost the day you betrayed me. You will never again have access to Irionite. You could have rivaled the finest magi of the age, Garkescu. Now you will never be anything more than a spellmonger, with only the powers within you at your disposal. I turned on my heel and faced the still dangling Kusi. Come, my lord, I said gently. Your rule here is ended for now. I am in charge, and as my first act, let us tour your cellar. The guards wisely stood aside as we descended the stairs to the cells under the dungeon. I almost wanted them to start something that I could finish. I had a lot of pent-up frustration to be worked out. We found Pentandra in her cell, the nicest of the four, as it had a kind of window in both the thick redwood door and also a vent above her, levitating about a foot off the filthy ground. There was a wry smile on her face as I made Kusi himself open the door. He did so quietly. I had tired of his babbling on the way down into the dungeon and quieted his voice with a spell, but his eyes still blazed in righteous indignation, and his mouth still moved in silent curses as he was compelled to do my bidding.
About time you showed up, was all Penny said.
She lowered her feet until they touched the floor, then stood up.
You took a lot longer than you should have.
I was distracted, I said as I embraced her.
So what possessed the little runt to get rough with me?
Fear of losing his place to me. Garkescu and Kay, that's the Castellan, convinced him that I had designs on his miserable little fief, and suggested that he take direct command of the war magi. He also didn't like the way you kept prattling on about us being all doomed if we stayed at Beauval Castle. Ironically, they put me into a position where I had to essentially take over and depose him to undo their mess.
Idiots, she breathed. It hasn't been a total waste, however. I've become well acquainted with your friend Gurkhal. Charming fellow for a Gervan. So what is all this about a sacred cave? It's fascinating. Gurkhal tried to explain it, but he doesn't know much outside of hagiography and propaganda.
The old god's cave, the cavern of Karamala, is under this castle, I explained. It's the most sacred of Gervani holy sites. As a matter of fact, we were just going to visit this lost wonder, weren't we, Kusi? The old knight's eyes continued to blaze, and his mouth worked rapidly. Thankfully, nothing came out. I had had some initial misgivings about deposing the man, but the longer I dwelt on it, the better I felt about it. As long as I had my witch stone, the chances of me hanging or being decapitated were acceptably low.
You go to see the sacred cavern of Karamala,
came a gravelly voice from the next cell over.
Take me, I beg of you. Slay me afterward, if you so desire. But let my last sight in this world be to look upon it,
Gurkhal begged, his furry black hands protruding through the bars, beckoning.
What do you think?
I asked Penny.
She shrugged.
Do you give me your parole?
Yes. Yes, 1,000 times.
You will not try to escape.
Dragons could not drag me away from this holy place.
There was no trace of deceit in his voice. Okay, I said. I nodded towards Kusi, who objected silently but fervently. I arranged for him to get a little jolt of pain up and down his spine, and after enduring a moment of that, he hurried to comply. The massive wooden door squeaked open, and Gurkhal bounded out, no worse for wear for his captivity that I could see.
I thank you, Menelan. You are truly a credit to your species.
It's nothing, I said as graciously as I could.
Okay, Kusi, let's go to this place. Where is it? He looked at me blankly for a moment. I then realized what was wrong, and with a wave of my hand I dropped the spell that bound him. I had it sealed up behind a wall down here. Which wall? He hesitated, and I raised my hand. He sighed and relented. At the end of the corridor. The original entrance was there. We built around it and tried to destroy it, but no hammer could break the stone, so I sealed it.
Sounds like a magical cave to me,
observed Penny, nodding her head. Lead on, I commanded him gruffly. We found the spot, and sure enough it had been thoroughly bricked over. It looked like a mere blank wall, the end of a corridor. I got out a work wand, as opposed to a war wand, and traced a rough outline of a doorway on it. Using the power of the stone, I pushed against the line, and in a few moments the blocks of stone tumbled away, revealing a dark and foreboding hole. A little light, Penny?
My pleasure.
In moments a brightly glowing globe appeared between her hands, a perfect mage light, and with a shove it dove into the hole. Suddenly the interior of the cave was illuminated, and we peered in. It was majestic, in a goblin sort of way. The cavern was a roughly elongated oval about 60 paces long by 40 paces wide, with a slight bend toward the center. The sides sloped gently up toward the roof, and crystals had been set at regular intervals, reflecting the glow of the mage light like 1,000 tiny mirrors. The floor was mostly flat and covered in sand, but at the far end it sloped up, and toward the middle it was broken by a rock formation of some sort. Every wall and the ceiling was covered by pictograms and hieroglyphs, either carved or painted into the stone, and runic Gervani letters filled the space between them. As exhibitions of Gervani art go, it was impressive. Some of the designs were obvious, like the Gervani thunder god, complete with stylized thunderbolt, leering down from a carefully painted mountaintop. Some were abstract to the extreme, lines and swirls that had no readily apparent meaning. It could have been some ancient language, I suppose. The floor was littered with debris, most heaped into sorted piles. I could make out boot prints, perhaps of Kusi's father or grandfather, wandering the chamber from pile to pile. The cave had an empty feel to it at the moment, but I could tell it had once been a center of activity and storage of important things. There was a cluster of little stone altars to my right, for example, that had obvious holes in them for some type of implements. There were spaces where objects had clearly rested for display in the past. Our goblin companion fell to his knees in awe.
"Gods of my fathers," Gakal croaked. "I am the first Gervan to view this cavern in almost 200 years. Blessed am I."
"When I was a boy," Kusi ventured tentatively, "this chamber was filled with all sorts of foul junk. Much of it was gold and silver. There were many jewels. My father ordered it sorted. The valuables we sold to merchants. Some of the more vile creations were burnt. The rest we just left."
"It must have been impressive once upon a time," I commented, stepping through the new-made doorway. I cast my own mage light to improve the illumination, and the shadows faded in its light.
"It was impressive and thoroughly evil. They sacrificed even their own kind to their foul gods. We found dozens of goblin heads in niches all along this wall, no doubt victims of barbaric sacrifice."
"Those were the heads of my ancestors," Gakal snarled. "They were the king and great shamans of the past. Their heads were placed here as a token of highest honor."
"I've heard of the skull cult in the Gervani," Penny mentioned conversationally. "They believe the spirit of their ancestors reside in the head, rather than the heart."
"The custom is not limited to the Gervani," I replied. "The Crinroc have a cult of skulls, as do some of the other barbarian tribes in the wilderlands and among the East Islanders."
"And like your Narasi ancestors?"
she asked, eyebrows cocked jauntily. "This was an old game that we played. She would advance the cause of imperial culture, while I championed, weakly, the sometimes confusing customs of my people. She was correct in this instance. My forefathers had a fetish about collecting the severed heads of the imperial soldiers who opposed them, and stacking them in huge pyramids.
and occasionally turning them into garish, ghoulish drinking vessels, so her comment stung a bit. Yes, actually, much like the head-collecting, horse-loving steppe barbarians, who toppled the majocracy. A disgusting habit, Kusi hissed bitterly. Depends on your culture. Pentandra shrugged. The Cormirans do some pretty icky things with their dead. They are considered an ancient and highly civilized people. I walked over and began to examine the piles of cast-off ritual rubbish. The largest was mostly trash, bits of cloth and leather and bone, broken pottery and the like. I tugged out my blade and poked through it, while Penny looked at another pile, as Gurkhal gazed adoringly at the pictographs in the mage light. Kusi stood near the entrance and pouted angrily. I wasn't particularly worried that he would start anything. I had dropped most of the control spells for him, but I had a few left that would snap back into place like a dog's leash at the first sign of trouble. He was behaving himself for now, but I knew he would try something eventually. I picked up two large pottery shards and fit them together. It was beautiful work, probably an oil lamp, with a primitive but vibrant design in vermilion and jet, showing dancing Gavani figures and strange beasts intertwined. It spoke of a sophisticated culture, perhaps more advanced than where the Gavani found themselves today. I felt the faint remnants of the magic that had once inhabited them. Gurkhal was right. This had been a reverent and holy place for many, many generations. Religious magic always has a certain feel about it, and this place felt like I was wading in it up to my hips. I moved on to a charred and broken section of wood, some ancient shaman staff I gathered from the shape and feel of it. There were no remaining spells, and it felt as if the entire thing had been expended in one last desperate act of defiance. I pictured gnarled, black, furry hands clutching the thing as the original owner fought to protect this shrine from defilement.
"Hey, what about these?"
called Penny from one of the other piles. I dropped the shard of staff and came to look at what she had found. It proved to be a pile of parchment, well-cured animal skins, actually, covered with the runic Gavani language. In the absence of moisture and vermin, and perhaps because of the innate power within this place, they had remained relatively intact, though spots were burned here and there. "Can you read Gavani?" I asked her.
"No. Can you?"
"Nope. Gurkhal, come here a moment, would you?" The Gurvan ambled over, a profound sense of contentment surrounding him despite the state of the temple. He halted at the pile and furrowed his brow at it.
"Holy books?"
he asked. "We were hoping you would know."
"I was a smith, not a shaman. I know my letters, but this is more than I can read. Without a lot of work,"
he amended. "And you're not particularly anxious to provide aid and comfort to the enemy. I understand." He shrugged his shaggy shoulders.
"In a few days it will not matter. The old god is coming. The great ghost returns."
"Stop saying that!" Kusi howled from where he had slunk. "He is not! That is merely an evil heathen superstition, a damned lie to try to make us yield out of fear."
The Gurvan and I looked at each other, then at Kusi.
"Well, there is something coming,"
I said, slowly and deliberately, "and based on the magical power it has shown so far, it will flatten us like so many bugs, superstition or not." I turned back to the pile and Gurkhal. "Can you even tell me what they might be? I don't want to take a lot of trouble for your great-great-great-aunt's gingerbread recipe."
"Well, I might, for the novelty value.
My dad might be interested, but it would be helpful if I knew what they said." He appeared to give it great thought, then nodded.
"I will try. It will take me a while, and more light would be helpful."
I raised my hand and another globe, smaller by half but twice as bright, came into existence over the pile. The Gurvan grunted, then began sorting through the papers. Penny moved on from the pile, more like she was eagerly moving through a busy market looking for a particular bolt of cloth than searching an ancient shrine for occult secrets. She didn't seem to be bothered by the ancient bones strewn about, or the musty smell of the cavern. I shrugged. Penny responded unusually in any situation. She had seemed perfectly content to languish in a prison cell, but I've seen her thrash a lazy serving girl for spilling soup and publicly humiliate tavern owners over the cleanliness of their establishments. We continued poking around the cave, noting a number of points of interest. Shrines to Gavani gods, ancient stories told out in pictures, and plenty of magical enchantments written into the stone walls. There were strong sorceries still woven into the very rocks around us, I could feel. When I found broken and abandoned mining tools of human make, I was able to verify that Kusi had sealed the place because he was, indeed, unable to destroy it. That cave was a magical wonder. It was a fascinating study of Gavani magic and window on their ancient culture. I'd gotten mere glimpses of the subject before now, enough flashes of their magical methods during combat and the power of their enchantments on the goblin stones. I'd even started to recognize a few of their techniques, I'd thought, becoming familiar enough with them to perhaps find weaknesses. The magic in the cave thoroughly dismissed that notion as naive. This was Gavani magic at its peak. The spells woven into the fabric of that space were complex tapestries of subtle spells, every bit as elaborate, ornate, and functional as the imperial style of magic in their way. Or, hell, I admitted to myself, as good as the tree folk's unique and potent system. The entire cave was a complex and delicate magical device, with hundreds, nay, thousands of possible uses. The runes so painstakingly painted or carved on the walls had bound within them intricate spells for working the weather, charms assisting the growth of crops, promoting fertility among the people, healing disease and wounds taken in battle, and appeals directly to the gods, from what I was able to determine with Gurkhal's help. He might not have been a shaman, but he was knowledgeable enough to point out that spells for healing were held within the crystal formations, spells for religious initiation were worked into the walls in iron, and copper, the Gavani metal associated with fertility, was used to create a complex series of spells in the ceiling of the place. I couldn't resist examining the place with a simple thaumaturgic essay, and neither could Pentandra. What amazed me the most was how many of the formations seemed to have multiple uses. It rivaled the fabled Palace of the Archmage before my people ruined it, or the Tower of Gelmari at the peak of its power. But it was also a terrible weapon. While I could not really say for certain, a good third of the spells about me had the sleek and deadly feel of war magic. Some required living sacrifice, that much I could see, and some were so obscure and powerful that I classed them as martial by default. There were amplifiers and dampers and filters and all sorts of magical control mechanisms that would allow a little power to go a long way, and a lot of power to be devastating to their foes. Us, in other words. I realized that a talented mage, if assisted with Irionite, could be able to do a serious amount of damage to someone with those enchantments. A dozen or so magi who knew what they were doing would become unstoppable, and the old god had hundreds of shamans. Was this then the answer to our prayers? This wonderful set of artifacts, this product of lifetimes of Gavani wizardry, would it allow us to turn the tide and throw the old god back into whatever crack he crawled from? No, not really. This was goblin magic, and I knew nothing about it beyond basic arcane cognates and the occasional real-world experience. I considered it eagerly, though, just for some respite to the hopelessness I was feeling. The thought of using the cave to strike down the old god, to drive his armies back and destroy him utterly, was pretty appealing. But I would have been a fool to mess around with a magical style I wasn't familiar with, even as a trained thaumaturge with Irionite. I couldn't even read or speak their language, and that would be essential if I was to understand the basics about how that cavern worked. Sure, there were a few things that I was pretty sure I could use, given time to study them, like the spells for prosperity and fecundity and increasing the fish supply. But that dark tangle of war spells scared me. I would use them only in a suicidal rage. "While you are down here," Kusi said after clearing his throat loudly, "perhaps your brilliant mind could clear up a mystery." He walked over to a roundish hillock of rock that sloped up from the floor and into a flat, clear space on the wall. "We always thought that this altar was used for a particularly cruel, sacrificial death, hanging upside down while disemboweled, for example. But that never seemed to be right. There was no idol, see, in front of it, just a circle cut into the rock, ringed by stones. Some of them were precious, and removed, as was the gold.
But why would anyone sacrifice to a god of nothing?
There were some old imperial cults who worshipped Rada, goddess of emptiness, back during the early Mojocracy's decadent period, Penny offered. It was stylish for a while, but she was never popular.
Who wants to go talk about nothing all night?
I can see this being a salon for the sophisticated courtiers of the imperial nobility, I replied dryly. Of course, your folk did have some pretty depraved ideas during that period.
No, Kusi is right. I studied the thing more closely, slipping up a more and more detailed form of mage sight as I did so. As it settled over me, I was startled nearly into speechlessness. This was no ordinary altar. I did some cursory thaumaturgic essays and swallowed hard. I quickly came to the conclusion that the area around the blankness was also the center of what the Imperials call a molopa, or arcane spatial insecurity. This is a complex subject which I'm going to attempt to paraphrase, so don't get upset if you don't understand it the first few times around. I know I had several sleepless nights wrestling with this concept back when I was taking advanced magical theory during my thaumaturgy courses at the academy. Consider a piece of cloth. From 5 feet away, it appears solid, a sheet of fabric. From 2 inches away, it becomes a rolling landscape of intertwining threads. Get even closer, and it becomes something else entirely. No matter how sturdy the cloth, there are going to be places where it is weaker than others. Nor will it be uniform. Take my sister's first piece of loom work, for example. In places the threads were so thick that they formed lumps, while in others the threads were so thin that you could see through them. Even the best pieces of storm-rated sailcloth will develop rips and tears along weak spots, and there are always weak spots, no matter how masterful the weaver. If you looked very carefully at a piece of cloth, you could find the thinnest spot and push a needle or something right through it with very little effort. Reality is like that cloth, except that it isn't flat, it isn't woven, and it isn't particularly cloth-like in any other way, save to poets and to weavers. But in this case, it's a useful metaphor. Without devolving into technical jargon, there are places where the very fibers of reality are so thick that magic has trouble working there. There are also places where reality is so weak that it occasionally rips and tears for an instant, and sometimes things slip through, tear, or other catastrophes occur. This was all theory, mind you, but it was theory backed up by centuries of thaumaturgical experimentation. Lodestones had something to do with it was thought, as were the arcane mathematics of astrology, but the standing theory had been that it was possible to discover naturally occurring thin spots in reality. The theory also suggests that if one had masterful control and access to a gargantuan amount of power, one could press a metaphysical needle through it. Why one would want to do this, except for the pure curiosity of it, is beyond me. A molopa isn't really a thing, an event, or even a place, but it can be all of them. The thaumaturges of the Mojocracy loved hunting them down and cataloguing them, though why one would want to do this outside of pure curiosity is beyond me. There are variations. There are even regularly occurring, fairly stable molopas, which seem to move and transform with the regularity of the planets and tides. A molopa is, first and foremost, an extreme condition of reality, and the truth is we really don't know shit about them, save how to occasionally identify them. Some are famous, like the two called the Twins, near a waterfall in Sabra, where strange bolts of fire sometimes shoot out into the river for no good reason, or the irregularly appearing thing out over the ocean, the Sea Magi I know as the Stormbringer, because it was supposed to, surprise, affect the weather. You can't move one, and they rarely move themselves, though it has happened. There have been others recorded, but most were unstable, fleeting affairs that could rain fish on a town or create enigmatic patterns in wheat fields overnight, hang around for a few hours, days, or weeks, then fade into existence? Simply put, a molopa is a weak spot that could theoretically be connected to any conceivable point, points, place, places, time, or times in the universe. Magic worked easier around the vicinity of most molopas, it had been suggested, due to the more plastic nature of reality in the area.
Needless to say, they are extremely rare and difficult to detect, and their very existence had sparked centuries-old controversies in erudite circles about the very nature of the universe. A stable Molopar, and its equally immovable anti-magical opposite, the Jevalar, like the famous Temajai, one on the island of Unstar, was a natural curiosity. This one was massive, compared to the reports of others I'd read, and it had been discovered by the Gavani and improved. If a regular Molopar was a thin spot, then this thin spot had been reinforced. Consider it a grommet in the fabric of space-time. In effect, a portal to where? Or when? Or what? The possibilities taxed my imagination, and I realized then why the old god wanted the place back so badly. If the great ghost had as much power at his disposal as he seemed to, then this place would make him about as omnipotent as a deity could ask for. With power, the theory runs, you can use an arcane needle to traverse through, or around, opinions varied, the Molopar to elsewhere, and possibly get back with stuff. A Molopar this size, arcane reinforced as it was, had enormous potential, I realized. Here the old god had a direct connection to worlds and planes of his choosing. It would take a lot of power and some seriously sophisticated spell work, but he seemed to have an endless supply of Irianite and an army of devoted, nay, fanatical, followers. A pity he wanted to kill off my entire race. With this, he might be able to manage to. So, Sire Kusi asked after he had decided I had studied it enough, what is it? I sat down in front of it and tried to remain calm. In the proximity of my sphere, it could be quite dangerous to let the absolute fear that was rising up my gullet manifest itself magically if I was too close to it. But the consequences were clear enough. I began to feel old and tired, so very tired of all of this. Despair beckoned to me, inviting me to just give up, while anger and fear insisted that my tired body and my overwrought mind do everything in its power to keep the old god and the Molopar from ever meeting. Somewhere in the middle, they crashed, and there was little I could do about it. But at least a few more things made sense. It's a magical gateway to pretty much anywhere, if you can find a way through. I can't tell without a far better understanding of Gavani magic, but I believe that this portal, when activated, could lead to anywhere in the world, or any other world, or to a lake of fire, the bottom of an ocean, a poisonous hell, or to nothing at all. This hole in the wall surrounds a rip in reality, or something like that. When the old god gets here, he will be able to use it to do pretty much anything he wants. Kusi looked shocked. Then we must destroy it. Impossible. Nothing is impossible, he said gallantly. Actually, destroying the Molopar would be. You see, there isn't an it to be destroyed. Even if you could disable the protection spells and bring this cavern down around it, it would still be here. You could flood it, burn it, hit it with a rock or pelt it with pillows, it still would be there. It will be here long after these mountains have eroded away. You can do anything to it because there's nothing to act upon. Just through. So it's dangerous. Not on its own, I don't think. But yes, this Molopar could well be our doom if old Grouchy gets control of it. Then the old god must be stopped, Kusi announced, as if by will alone it could be accomplished. Plenty of noble fighting spirit left in the old bird. The old god cannot be stopped, Gakal called out from where he was crouched by the manuscripts. Penny returned from her snooping to see what all the commotion was about. Both of you shut up! While it felt good to say it, my feelings fueled the desire. The silence spell that I'd used so recently on Kusi was back up and extended to the Gervan as well. I shook my head when I'd realized what I'd done and started to take it down when I stopped. A few moments of peace would be welcome, I decided. I didn't get it. Pentandra had overheard us. This is a Molopar, she asked, intensely interested. Like the twins. Yes, it is. At least I think it is. A real honest-to-God stable Molopar, augmented by ancient Govani shamans to let them travel anywhere and bring anything to them that they wanted.
I think. Probably an artifact left over from the wars between the Alka'alon and the Gavani a few thousand years ago. By itself, that would be amazing. Put it together with the magic in this cavern, and it's a wonder how the Gavani ever lost any war.
I think it could be that they forgot how to use it. Min, some of these enchantments are thousands of years old. I'm not a specialist in magical archaeology, or even as good a thaumaturge as you are. But if the results of my tests are correct, the most recent spells used here were the ones devoted to fertility and prosperity, along with the war spells.
Primitive tribal magic, I nodded. It also explains why it's so easy to do magic in this vale. Not much in the way of resistance, thanks to this thing.
Yes, but there are great works here that haven't been used in millennia, truly sophisticated spells. It hints at a much more sophisticated thaumaturgy than the shamanic magic they practice now. The Gavani seem to have had a pretty advanced civilization once, but that was a long time ago. Long before the Majocracy, even. Possibly before humanity came from the void. I wonder if the old god could date from that time.
It would make a lot of sense. But how, exactly? Time travel? With the Molopar, that would be theoretically possible, and it would explain why he wants it back so badly. Or perhaps he's just been asleep. There are theoretical stasis spells that would preserve someone in a time-free environment. Sir Lan did some impressive experiments a few decades ago. Such a spell would not be beyond the ancient Gavani, if these enchantments are any example of their craft. And of course, there is the possibility that he is just a regular old pissed-off deity of vengeance.
Does it matter?
She asked, shaking her head so her hair flopped gracefully over her shoulder.
If he's coming here, we can assume for the sake of argument that it isn't for the mystical and cultural importance of the site. He's after that thing. So we had better decide if there is some way we can use it against him.
It won't hurt to look, I said, grinning wryly. There was no reason that the Molopar wouldn't react poorly to our examination and fry us in the process, but I was becoming so accustomed to fatalistic despair that I was unconcerned with the possibility. Considering our situation, accidental death suddenly looked pretty appealing. I turned back to the Molopar and reflected on this force of nature that was neither matter nor energy, but mere potential. In mage sight, it barely registered. It didn't glow with brightness of magic, except at the perimeter. It merely glowered darkly, a faint dark purple disc hovering in space. But the tracery of spells around the perimeter, which I assumed were designed to control the manner and type of magical force employed, made a brilliant and elaborate spiderweb that stretched the length of the cavern. I tried to trace the lines of control that emanated from the rim of the stone, and gave it up as futile a moment later. Gavani magic was just too strange for me to recognize more than basic lines of force. Finding the device was academically fascinating, and certainly strategically significant, I knew. But how could I turn this to my advantage? If I couldn't keep the great ghost away from it, was there any way I could use it myself to good effect? I could try to open the portal myself, I reasoned, and by force of will alone have it transport me someplace safe, like under my parents' bed back home. Without the supporting enchantments the Gavani had used to refine its use, however, I doubted I would have the strength or the control to undertake such a potent spell. Thaumaturgy demands that a spell of that kind needs an abundance of both, and you don't mess around with something as powerful and unknown as a Molopar. More likely, I would be killed in the attempt. The forces involved were titanic, and if I was already casting spells without conscious thought, then I wasn't nearly focused enough to even give it a try. There were limits to the capacities of my Irionite, I knew, and we'd bump into those fairly quickly if we tried to use it. Not to mention my personal limits. That kind of powerful spell takes a toll on the mage, and the human body, not to mention the human mind, has limits. But perhaps one of the other magi would have an idea about that. True, most of the war magi were young and experienced only in war spells, but many of them had studied particularly arcane areas. Talaman might have some thoughts on it. I wish Sandoval was here. He was a great thaumaturge, almost as good as I was. But we had a wealth of talent to work with, and I was hopeful. A meeting of the minds might produce a better answer, I reasoned.
My thoughts were interrupted by Penny, who was thoughtfully chewing her lip. I still found that adorable, despite my feelings for Alia.
Min, you mentioned something about Kirsiev, that evergreen tree?
Yeah. My research shows strong support for the theory that Kirsiev sap is the building block for Irionite. Why do you ask?
Don't quote me on this,
she said carefully, but I think I can design a spell that will actually activate this thing and control it. That's the good news. But it depends upon whether or not we can generate sufficient power and hold it for enough time. But if we did, then we might be able to establish a kind of portal to, well, to somewhere else. Anywhere else.
Exactly,
she sighed. That's bloody great news, I answered cautiously. How much power are you talking? She told me in technical thaumaturgical jargon. It was a lot. More than our individual stones were capable of, I was certain. There are other ways to manifest and augment power, though, as any good thaumaturge knows.
Ishi's tits.
Are you considering a human sacrifice, then? That's about the only thing I know of that... If we had the power to... Oh. I think I see what you...
Oh. Well?
I guess... I stumbled as my questions answered.